This podcast is brought to you by AJ Products, made in Sweden for the rest of the world. Visit ajproducts.ie to see how we can make your workplace work for you.
This week, hopes were raised and then dashed that a ceasefire could quickly be reached in Gaza.
Officials from Hamas said they'd accepted a deal that includes a limited ceasefire. But the Israelis replied that the deal was unacceptable to them.
On Tuesday, Israeli troops took control of the Rafah crossing, where vital international aid passes through to 2.3 million Palestinians. Now there is growing international pressure on Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to hold back on a potentially devastating operation in the city of Rafah, a last resort for over 1 million Gazan refugees.
Palestinian news outlets reporting that Israeli forces are shelling the area. This, of course, is where so many civilians have sought refuge during this terrifying and horrible conflict.
This is in the news from the Irish Times. I'm Bernice Harrison. Today, what will it take for Israel to cease fire in Gaza? I talked to reporter Mark Weiss. On Monday, Hamas announced that it would accept the terms of a ceasefire deal, negotiated with the help of Qatari and Egyptian mediators. But it soon became clear that Israel was not going to accept the deal. Mark, can you give us the timeline of these ceasefire negotiations over the past few weeks? How have the talks been unfolding behind the scenes? Did Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu explain why the terms of the deal were not acceptable?
Well, not everything is as it appears in the Middle East. As you know, for the last 2.5 weeks, there's been an Egyptian proposal on the table, coordinated with Israel and Qatar and the Americans, to bring about a ceasefire, a three-stage ceasefire, which would lead to the release of the hostages. The main sticking point from the beginning was the Hamas demand for a total end to the war and Israel's refusal, at this juncture at least, to commit to that. What happened on Monday night was a quite dramatic announcement by Hamas that they had accepted, as you just mentioned, the ceasefire deal. But what happened in practice was that they accepted terms of a deal that was radically different than the Egyptian framework that had been on the table for more than 2 weeks. Different in almost every key aspect. I'll just give you a couple of examples to illustrate the point. The initial Egyptian proposal suggested that in the first stage of the deal, which would last about 40 days, 33 living Israeli hostages would be released. The acceptance of Hamas indicated that it wouldn't be 33 living hostages. It would be a number of hostages that they're including dead and alive. So that's obviously not something Israel would accept. It was a very significant step backwards. Another key clause was that Israel would no longer have a power of veto over the Palestinian security prisoner that will be released as part of this deal, which means potentially that Hamas would be able to insist that dozens of hardcore Palestinian militants who've been responsible for killing of Israeli civilians would be released from Israeli prisons without Israel even having a say. So that's just two examples of why the Hamas acceptance, as they stated, was not actually agreeing to the original deal. In many senses, it was a significant step back. But despite this, Israel said they would send a low-level delegation to Cairo to continue the talks. Those talks, today's session at least, have just ended with no apparent breakthrough. So it looks at the moment that the talks are very stuck.
Well, the next day, that was Monday, the next day, Tuesday, Israeli forces took control of the Rafah border crossing. That's the sole crossing between Egypt and the city of Rafah in the southern part of the Gaza Strip. And that was seen as a prelude to the long-promised military incursion into the city. Now, Israel says it needs to go in to destroy the remnants of Hamas. But there is huge opposition to this move because 1.4 million refugees may be sheltering there, and that's according to the UN. Why does the Israeli government say this operation is necessary? What specifically does it want to achieve?
There's a couple of elements here. The first element is that in order for Israel to destroy Hamas's military capabilities, it has to defeat all the Hamas battalions in the Gaza Strip. Most of them, including the heaviest battalions that were based in and around Gaza City and in and around Gaza's second biggest city, Khan Yunis, have already been destroyed. There's only 5.5 to 6 battalions left. 4 of them are based in Rafah. But that's actually not the most important element here. The most significant, strategically, from Israel's point of view, is what you've just mentioned, the Rafah crossing, and also the border road between Rafah and the Mediterranean, what is called in Israel the Philadelphia Corridor. It's believed that nearly all the Hamas arms have crossed either into Gaza, either via the Rafah crossing or via tunnels under this border road. If Israel wants to be sure that Hamas will not be able to rearm and reestablish itself as a military force in the Gaza Strip, there has to be a solution to the arms smuggling from the Egyptian Sinai into Gaza. So the seizing of the Rafah crossing by Israeli troops was a very significant strategic achievement. And Israel also controls now about a third of the border road. The problem from the Israeli point of view is that most of the arms are smuggled via tunnels between Gaza and the Egyptian Sinai. And in the long run, a solution will also have to be found to that, as far as the Israeli military is concerned, to ensure that Hamas will not be able to re-establish itself as a significant military force. And now the battalions remain in place. Israel is not extending the Rafah operation at this stage. As you said, there is very significant opposition to this from almost the entire international community, including Israel's closest ally, the Americans. And interestingly, overnight, the Pentagon confirmed that they have suspended an arms shipment to Israel of precision weapons, maybe as a warning to Israel not to extend its Rafah operation into Rafah city itself. And remember, the Rafah crossing is not actually in the city. It's about 3 kilometers away. So it may be that if the deadlock continues in the ceasefire talks, Israel will extend the operation to Rafah itself. That remains to be seen.
Well, aid agencies have predicted a catastrophe if this is to happen, both due to the ensuing carnage, but also the cutting off of aid that has been coming in through the Rafah crossing into Gaza. Oxfam's representative said that from the humanitarian perspective, no credible humanitarian plan for an attack on Rafah exists. And the US, as you say, Israel's most important ally, has clearly stated it doesn't want this to happen. So huge external pressure. Is such pressure making any difference to Israeli decision making?
I think on the question of the aid, there are now alternatives to the Rafah crossing. The Rafah crossing has been closed since the Israeli forces entered there. But over the last few weeks, 4 crossings have been opened in the northern Gaza Strip. That enables aid shipments to arrive in Gaza, even if Rafah is closed. This morning, the Kerem Shalom crossing in the southern Gaza Strip was reopened. That had been closed for a few days after a mortar fire from militants close to Rafah hit the crossing, killing 4 Israeli soldiers. Israel this morning reopened that crossing, so that's another access point. And we expect also another significant development in the coming days, the temporary pier that the US military constructed on the coast of Gaza is expected to be up and running within a few days. And that could be another potential source of massive aid shipments to the Gaza Strip. So even if the Rafah crossing remains closed, there will be solutions. And the other problem is, as you said, the 1 million or so refugees in Rafah who fled from the northern Gaza Strip and the central Gaza Strip. Israel has facilitated a large area along the Gaza coast, about 15 kilometers away from Rafah, called the Al-Mawasi area, with thousands of tents there and 4 field hospitals. But it remains to be seen that if there is a major operation in Rafah, that will be enough to absorb all the potentially new refugees from Rafah.
Meanwhile, we are learning more about a U.S. decision last week to halt certain types of weapons deliveries to Israel. Among those weapons are bombs of various sizes, with a particular focus on very large 2,000-pound bombs. The official said that given the effect that the ordinance has on dense population centers like Rafah, the White House is particularly focused on ending their use.
Well, as you say, the U.S. has withheld delivery of large bombs to Israel. That surely is a sign of the growing rift between Washington and Jerusalem over the conduct of the war.
I think you're right. I think it's the clearest indication so far that the U.S. and Israel are no longer entirely on the same page. Remember, there has been massive American military supplies to Israel throughout the war. Israel always feared that if push comes to shove and there would be a showdown with the U.S. on a specific disagreements over something, and now it's happening over Rafah, that this would be Washington's response. They would withhold arms shipments. It's happening now. It remains to be seen if this is a one-off and they will patch up their differences, or it will be the beginning of a more significant US embargo on continuing arms supplies to Israel. In the background to this is the situation on Israel's northern border, where there have been daily exchanges of fire with Hezbollah. The potential exists on the northern border for a much more significant confrontation, leading to the possibility of all-out war between Israel and Hezbollah. If this happens, Israel will certainly not be able to conduct a second front without ongoing US supplies. So Israel badly needs American supplies, both to continue the operations in Gaza and to be prepared potentially for a more significant flare-up on the northern border. And the background to all of this is that Prime Minister Netanyahu is, from the beginning of the war basically, has been walking a tightrope between the demands of his right-wing coalition partners and the Biden administration. It's very difficult for him to please both parties. So his response basically has been to procrastinate, to play for time. We could argue that the Rafah limited operation so far is playing for time to appease his right-wing coalition partners. But if Israel decides on a more significant operation in Rafah, this could cross Washington's red lines, and maybe the Prime Minister will finally have to decide what he wants. Does he want to keep his coalition together and appease the right wing, or does he want to maintain Israel's strategic alliance with the US?
So if, in fact, the hard right members of his cabinet, they've threatened to collapse the government if he doesn't go into Rafah and if he makes peace with Hamas, if, as you say, he has to make a decision, if he decides not to go into Rafah because of this international pressure, this pressure specifically coming from Washington, how do you see that playing out for him politically and personally at home?
From his point of view, he's in an almost impossible position, because if he takes actions to appease his hard right coalition partners, then the centrist ministers in the emergency war cabinet, Benny Gantz and Gadi Eisenkot, if they perceive that Netanyahu is taking positions in order to keep himself as prime minister that go against decisions that go against Israel's national interest, then they are likely to quit the war cabinet, leaving Netanyahu in a very precarious situation from that point of view. So he is in a very difficult position. There are increasing demands from, as you can imagine, from relatives in Israel of the hostages, who also, many of them, believe that Netanyahu's top priority is not to get the hostages back. And time is running out for the hostages, as you can imagine. It's already been 215 days. It's quite clear that the longer the hostages remain in Hamas captivity, the less of them, the numbers of them alive will be less and less. We don't know, actually, how many of the hostages are still alive. And the longer it goes on, though, that number will decrease.
So, Mark, what would it take, in your view, for Netanyahu to agree to a ceasefire?
I think if it was a ceasefire that the majority of the Israeli public perceived as acceptable deal, then I think Netanyahu would have no choice. People's lives are at stake here, particularly the hostages. He would have to go for a deal that would be reasonable, is backed by the international community. Whether Israel can achieve that without a total end to the war is doubtful. There's all kinds of language being used which doesn't include the term end to the war, such as sustainable, quiet, et cetera, these kind of diplomatic nuances. But it's clear, I think, at this juncture that if Israel wants to get the hostages out alive and return of all the ones that have been killed, then probably there is no choice other than to agree to ending the war. Even such a deal would be very painful from Israel's point of view, because it would entail necessarily releasing hundreds of Palestinian militants held in Israeli jails, many of them people who were involved directly or indirectly with the murder of Israeli civilians. So whatever happens, the price, as far as Israel is concerned, is going to be very difficult. If there's a deal that will leave Hamas in control of Gaza, that's also going to be a very difficult position for the Prime Minister to adopt, that will probably lead to a collapse of his government.
Mark, do you get any sense of a timeline for a deal? You talked about the deal being sort of 2.5 weeks in the making before it emerged at the weekend, the acceptance by of whatever they interpreted the deal to be by Hamas, the rejection by Israel. Do you get any sense of a timeline?
Well, there's no certainty at all at this juncture that there actually will be a ceasefire. Things at the moment are deadlocked. There seems to be little optimism on either side at the moment. As I said, if anything, we've taken steps back over the last few days. The ceasefire deal itself will probably be in three stages of around 40 days each. That's from the release of the first hostage to a cessation of all hostilities, if we ever get there. So the time frame is around about 120 days. And that's the optimistic scenario. We could be facing the total collapse of the talks over the next few days. CIA Director William Burns has just ended a meeting in Jerusalem with Prime Minister Netanyahu. There's no indication yet if any breakthrough is achieved there. So we're at a very critical juncture. I mean, we've been saying this for weeks, but we really are, these days are a very critical juncture. No one has any idea where we're heading. Are we heading for collapse of the ceasefire talks and full-scale operation in Rafah? Or are we heading towards long-term truce that will eventually lead to the Israeli troops withdrawing from Gaza? And even then, what will happen afterwards? Will Hamas remain in power? Is there any other option on the table? It doesn't look like it at the moment. A lot of uncertainty and not a lot of optimism at this moment.
Mark, you're in Jerusalem. What's the mood like there?
Pretty depressing, actually. Whereas most of the world's concern, I think, is over the humanitarian crisis in Gaza and the large number of casualties there, that is an issue in Israel, of course. But for Israelis, most families here are connected in one way or another to the hostages. I think there's hardly a family in Israel that doesn't know directly one of the hostages or who has friends or relatives who know one of the hostages. And many believe that this may well be the last realistic chance to rescue the hostages. If there's no deal now, it may well be a long time, if ever, that there will be a solution that will bring the hostages home.
The most important thing is to bring the hostages back and to get humanitarian aid into Gaza. And that's the most important thing, and the ceasefire will serve that.
The hostages' relatives are, quite frankly, desperate. They're protesting every day.
We need a deal. We we're not Rafah. If the army will go inside Haifa, we're probably going to lose most of the hostages over there, and we must a deal before Rafah. Rafah need to be after a deal.
They feel that many in the government have not prioritised the return of the hostages. They've prioritised other issues, such as defeating Hamas militarily. And the price for this may well be that many of the hostages who are still alive won't be alive for long and will never return home.
That's it for today. For more coverage of the war in Gaza, subscribe at irishtimes.com/subscribe. I'm Bernice Harrison. My thanks to Mark Weiss. This episode was produced by Declan Conlon. In the news, we'll be back tomorrow.
This podcast is brought to you by AJ Products, creating a more friction-free office. Made in Sweden for the rest of the world. Visit ajproducts.ie to see how we can make your workplace work for you.